We traveled to beautiful Sherman Oaks, California, for a visit with a man whose name will conjure up a tremendous amount of memories for anyone who ever danced in Chicago or who listened to any number of programs during the golden age of radio, and who is enjoying life out here at the Horace Height Magnolia Estates Retirement Living Complex. We're talking about Horace Height, and I'm so happy to be here.
No, it's not retirement living.
It's not retirement
living. Not retired. No, this is an up-and-going place. We had our St. Patrick's Day party last night, and if you'd been here, it's not retirement.
Nobody's retiring here.
No, we have a group of wonderful people.
This is a very beautiful complex here, and how long have you had this
development? I've had this for 25 years, and we've never had a vacancy, and everybody's very happy. Well, as you drive in, you have the five big waterfalls in the front, and then you have the birds in the middle, all pheasants, golden pheasants, or all kinds of pheasants. And it changes the atmosphere. Somebody that's in a very extreme, tense business world, the drive in here, they relax right away.
You're exactly right. And you come off the main street out here,
Magnolia Boulevard,
and you turn in here, and you're in another world.
That's right.
And I hope that we can hear some of the birds in the background. It's a charming, delightful setting here, and the sun is shining so brightly.
That's good.
It's great. I'd like to talk with you a little bit about your career and about some of the good old days. I think these are good days for you and for everybody around here.
Good.
But there were some nice days. And I think you contributed so much to the golden age of radio, as it's called, and to the entertainment of an awful lot of people over the years. When did you form your first band?
Well, my first band was formed in 1920 at the University of California at Berkeley. And these are some of the programs that we created. So you can see our minds were always busy. We were always working.
Well, that first band at the university, you were not going on the radio with that yet, were you?
No, that was just six pieces. Six pieces and a dog. Lobo, the German Shepherd dog, was a tremendous hit.
What did he play?
Well, he sat in the band. He rang a bell.
Oh, he
and
did.
The bells of St. Mary's. And he'd sit up when he rang the bell, and the people would come to see the dog and dance to us.
How would you characterize your band at that time? Was it a collegiate band or? Was
oh yes,
it a,
definitely.
Just definitely that. Huh?
Yeah, put us through college.
Oh, it did.
Yeah.
Oh, that's okay too.
Yeah.
Nice to be able to get your way through college by doing something that you enjoy so much. What was your first professional engagement outside of college?
Outside of college? Well, my first professional engagement was down outside of Stanford University. And I played for a band, some other band leader. And I asked the owner, I said, how's business tonight? And he answered me and said it was lousy. And so then the orchestra leader saw me do it, and he fired me on the spot. So I realized right there and then that I had to have my own band, that I wasn't cut out to be just a piano player in a band. So that's what I did. I went out and got my own job at the Claremont Hotel in Berkeley. And we started with three pieces. No, we started with five pieces for three nights a week. And that was a very big success.
And how long did you play there?
Well, we stayed there for about 5 years. I play football with the University of California team. And I used to require the members of my band to get out and put up posters. So on our opening night, I told the manager of the Claremont Hotel, I said, if you hire my band, we'll have 1,000 people here tonight, first night. And I had no idea, But I got my band to put up posters all around the stadium, around the Coliseum, and all the telegraph poles. And so the people going up saw that we were opening at the Claremont, going up to the game.
Oh, I see.
And then I was arrested during the game, even though I played on the team. And the headline was, University of California football star under arrest for putting up all these signs.
Oh. You see?
And of course, they released me right away. But when I went to the hotel, you couldn't get in. I couldn't even get near the place.
You got a little extra publicity out of the whole business.
Nothing like it. I'll never forget it.
And, of course, you had 1,000 people there.
Oh,
that
we had
night.
Way over 1,000. Oh, they couldn't handle them at the hotel.
That's wonderful. Did you ever go on the road with the band then from that point or right
No,
after
I had to go through
point?
College. I spent 4 years there.
Uh-huh.
And then I played the campus theater at the University of California, then the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland, and then to the Warfield Theater in San Francisco, where, incidentally, we accompanied Al Jolson on one of his only appearances up there.
Oh, my.
And then we went into a theater, the Golden Gate Theater in San Francisco. And there we were the first to have what you call a band policy up on the stage. I asked the manager if he'd let my band, who were all college people,
mm-hmm.
if he'd let us go up on the stage, and we were the background then for all the acts. That was something brand new in show business, and they still do it, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the first one, and it was tremendously successful. The theater had been losing money, and the minute I put in that policy, why, we started to make money. The theater did. So we stayed there a long time. And then we jumped from there, after this period of time, to the Drake Hotel in Chicago. It was a big gamble, because we only had a contract for 4 weeks at the Drake Hotel, and I pulled that whole crew back there, 30 people.
How did you obtain that contract? On the strength of the performance in California? And somebody saw you and said, we'd like you to come to the Drake, or did you put 1,000 posters up from here to there?
No, I used to call on the people that would visit San Francisco, the big business executives.
Mm-hmm.
And I met a man by the name of Frank Heider from the Stuart Warner Company.
Mm-hmm.
And he put us on the air from San Francisco radio. It was really something brand new. To originate from San Francisco is a miracle. But they wanted it to come back to Chicago. So they promised the Drake Hotel their convention business, which was, let's say, $50,000-$60,000.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
For whatever they did there on their convention, if they would hire my band back there at the Drake Hotel in Chicago. So that's the way it was arranged. Then they didn't ever hear my band, excepting on radio, you see.
Well, that was, of course, a very good place to audition for
and
them
then,
if they needed that.
All
by
Chicago
doing it on radio.
People, or most of the Chicago people, will certainly remember Benny Marshall.
Mm-hmm.
He was the architect for the Drake and the architect for the Edgewater Beach Hotel. And he was a great jokester. He used to love to play jokes. So we got back there. You know what it is. We traveled in our cars. You knew, know how exhausted we were when we got there. And I went into the hotel, and I said, is Mr. Marshall here? And, you know, that street was just packed up with traffic, and the police were out there trying to get the cars off. And he said, I met Mr. Marshall, and I said, I'm a Horace Height. You're a new orchestra leader. He said, I didn't think I engaged you. He said, let me look at the contract. He said, I don't think I engaged a Horace Height. And he went into his office, and he said, by golly, he said, you are the one that I engaged. He said, I thought it was a colored leader. You know, there was a black leader.
Mm-hmm.
There was a Les Height black band, you see. So he was just playing a joke on me.
Oh, he was kidding.
He was kidding me. He was scared the life out of me.
Yeah, after that long trek.
After 2,000 miles.
Well, when you opened then at
well,
the Drake.
We opened slowly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just, who knew Horace Height? Nobody. And then we went to Joe Stein of Music Corporation of America, and he arranged to put us on WGN. half hour mm-hmm. every night. And the minute the people saw the King Sisters and Alvino Ray and all the troop, all fine young people, why, it just clicked. And in 4 weeks, we were doing capacity business. Saturday nights were like New Year's Eve parties.
Oh, my.
And then we originated from there. We originated the program Answers by the Dancers. You have to excuse my voice, but we've had an epidemic of the flu out here.
Oh, yeah. So. You mean the flu dares to come to sunny California, too?
Yeah, it does.
Now, Answers by the Dancers was really the first of a whole string of audience participation programs.
That's right.
That you were involved
with
in radio.
Answered by the Dancers was the first impromptu ad-libbing program. And the way it happened was the microphone, they were very strict in those days about ad-libbing on the air. You had to put everything down on a piece of paper and then mm-hmm. cleared. And you had to read off, so now the next number is going to be so-and-so and so-and-so. But a microphone dropped over on the ground, on the floor. And I jumped down to pick it up, and to cover, I started to talk to some people. And I asked them, I said, why are you here? And they said, it's our wedding anniversary. Very interesting. And I said, what song would you like to have us play? And they named a song, and the boys got it out of the book, and we played their song, and that was Answers by the Dancers. And from that program, Kay Kaiser picked up College of Musical mm-hmm. Knowledge. Mm-hmm. This is going way back. I doubt whether...
He was over at the Blackhawk then, wasn't he?
Yeah, at the Blackhawk. Uh-huh. The Music Corporation increased on this idea of Answers by the Dancers, mm-hmm. which incidentally we kept for years. And into New York, when we were at the Biltmore Hotel, we had Answers by the Dancers. And we were on the air all the time at that particular period. There wasn't any television.
Mm-hmm. No television at that point yet.
No, it was tremendous.
And you had the remote broadcasts, where they mostly times a week?
Yeah, from the hotel, we had remote broadcasts, then an hour on Saturday night, Answers by the Dancers, and then later on it was, more things came along, like the Pot of Gold and the Treasure Chest.
I want to talk with you about the Pot of Gold, but I also want to ask about when did you start first calling your organization Horace Hite and his Musical Nights? Was that, did that go way back to college days?
No, it was first the Alamite Brigadiers. See, we were on for Stuart Warner, and that was Alamite.
Oh, I see.
The Horace Hite and his Alamite Brigadier. Everything rhymed in my career.
Uh-huh.
You know, as we went on, it was Horace for Philip Morris. It was Horace Hite for Lucky Strike. It was, everything rhymed up. Family Night with Horace Hite. It had to rhyme.
Anniversary night with Horace Hite and
all that. Yeah, that's right.
So that was, but then the Musical Nights, where about did that come in?
That came in after Alamite canceled. Alamite went off the air. See, we advertised not the Alamite system mm-hmm. that's on most automobiles at that time, but we advertised Alamite oil, and they had no outlets for it.
Oh,
so you
see,
then they had to give it up. They just couldn't keep it.
They couldn't distribute it. Once you had the demand, they couldn't find a place to distribute it.
They couldn't find the places to buy the oil.
Stuart Warner is a long-established Chicago area business. Maybe we can get them to sponsor this section again. Let's go right back to 1932. The Pot of Gold was an extremely popular radio program. So much so that I think at one point Fred Allen in his Town Hall Tonight broadcast was doing a takeoff called The Tub of Silver on yours. But how did the Pot of Gold program come about for you?
Well, this is a story that might be hard to believe, but I was playing at the Gibson Hotel in Cincinnati, and business was very bad. And we opened day and date with another hotel, I think the Netherlands Plaza. Mm-hmm. And we were at the Gibson, so business was terrible. And as I was going out the door, and we had been canceled, a little newsboy whom I had given a dollar to every night said, Mr. Hite, he said, I have an idea that would just be wonderful on radio. And I said, well, what is it? And he said, just give money away. And I laughed. I said, well, this is a fast way to go broke. And then I started to think about it, and I had two fraternity brothers in Cincinnati that picked it up and started to work on it. And then Harold Hackett of Music Corporation of America got a hold of the idea, and they put it into the pot of gold format, mm-hmm. the telephone books.
Yeah, they spun a wheel of fortune or something like
that. Yeah, a big wheel. I have it right there in my trophy room.
Oh, have to see it. And what did they do? They took spun the wheel to decide what city?
Section. What section of the country?
Uh-huh.
The whole country was put into volumes. So the first spin was to get the volume.
Of the phone book, you mean?
Yeah.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Then the second was what page in that volume. You know, there was just a tremendous amount of pages in mm-hmm. each volume. And then the third spin was starting from the left-hand corner going down, eliminating businesses, so forth. Why, you select the numbers.
So the line 42 was...
Yes, such person, such uh-huh. and such a city.
And then you would place the phone call to him?
If he was home, we got $1,000.
Just like that. He didn't have to answer any question or anything else.
No, it was a fantastic thing.
And the audience was tremendous for it.
Well, people put in telephones. Nobody would call anybody else during that period. And the telephone company didn't like it at all. But it was tremendous. And the rating went up so fast. It was a top-rated show for many years.
Now, this started in about 1939, didn't it?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
I'll never forget, Bob Hope was right opposite us in the studio. And he'd come over. There's a great deal of doubt whether the pot of gold would be allowed due to the FBI, due to, it's not the FBI, I was going to say
FCC?
That.
FCC?
FCC.
Uh-huh.
They might call it a lottery.
But so there was nothing to buy, so.
No, they fixed the attorneys, got around that.
Uh-huh.
And so Bob Hope would come over and he'd say, gee, are you on tonight? You're still on? He said, my rating's gone up 8 points. He followed our show, you see.
Oh,
and he's a wonderful man. Uh-huh. Have you seen Bob out here?
I have not had an opportunity to visit with him yet.
Well, he's one of the greatest that ever lived. He really is something.
But his rating went up along
with yours.
His rating
went up 8, and he wanted to stay up, naturally.
Mm-hmm. So he wanted you to stay on.
Yeah.
How long did the pot of gold last on radio?
About 7 years.
7 years. A lot of money you gave away over that period of time.
Not so much. When you think of what they give away now, you know, they give away now in one show what we gave away maybe
in
a year.
But you see, you think in 1939, someone sitting by their telephone waiting for a call that might net them $1,000, that was really a lot of money at that point. And it was very unique.
But
years
you see,
later,
the public now are smart. You know, they realize the odds against them.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So if you can give $100,000 away now, they wouldn't tune in. They'd say, my odds are... What chance have I got?
Yes, but in states where they have the lottery, the state lottery, the big winner could make $30 million or something. So people, they know the odds, but they just, it's the game of chance, I think. It's the excitement that it could happen to me, you know.
Yeah.
And I think you capitalized on that very well and did a nice job with all of that. There was, I read someplace that said that the motion picture theaters on the night
your
program was on, they were hungry for business. People were staying home.
Well, say they'd advertise in the theater. If your name is called during this period, if you're in the theater, we will let you know. We'll take the picture off you and answer the phone.
So what did they do? They registered with the theater owner?
No. They could tell where the call was, you see.
Oh, I see. So if it was...
They would hear the call... If it was like you take Sherman Oaks mm-hmm. or right now, if it's Sherman Oaks, they'd tune the person in. They'd get them on the telephone or they'd flash on the screen, Mrs. So-and-so. Is she in the audience?
Oh, I see. Well, that's really shows the power of radio at that period of time.
Did.
And, of course, the power of the material that you put together. Now, in between all the phone calls and the... and the spinning of the wheel. Of course, you put on a very fine variety program then for the
listening
audience.
Yes, it's a good variety show.
Was this a half-hour show or
half-hour?
A half-an-hour show.
You know, but the pot of gold on radio, this idea was owned by Music Corporation of America. Mm-hmm. And so then we put it in theaters. We would give anybody in the town of that we're playing in, let's say Washington, D.C., although that's a bad city because the FCC was, they were scared to death there. But let's take any city. That's the telephone.
Go ahead. No. Answer. You can answer that.
No, I'll answer that later.
Okay.
We put it on the stage. And if you were in the theater when we called your name out in this telephone mm-hmm. book of the city we were in, why, you'd get the $1,000.
Oh, I see.
And the people would sit there all day long. They'd get there at 9 o'clock in the morning and sit there.
And just hope that the...
They'd look at the picture and look at the show five times.
That wasn't so good for business, was it?
No, it wasn't. Well, no, they did tremendous business.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Now, you moved from the Pot of Gold program to a... I have a note that says you were involved with a treasure chest broadcast.
That was an offspring.
For
our sponsors, uh-huh. our sponsors for the Pot of Gold, their business grew so big, mm-hmm. so tremendous. They went from two or three machines to three floors of machines that they said, well, let's put on another show. So the treasure chest, that was celebrate anniversary night with Horace Hite. And see, then they'd reach, we'd get married couples. Mm-hmm. One year married, 10 years married, then the golden wedding. And then they'd reach into the golden treasure chest. And they'd pull out a prize, whatever it was. Very nice prize.
Mm-hmm. And from some one of the sponsors or from just...
not an automobile in those days. Uh-huh. A very nice present.
You, I think, were involved with a program during the... latter part of the war years, World War II, where you brought returning veterans onto the air to talk about their
welcome
skills.
Home. No, we tried to get them jobs. Uh-huh. Remember, all these boys came back; they're out of work. So we made a connection with Western Union, and we'd put on, let's say, a carpenter, and all over America, they'd say. We'd say, who would like to have a carpenter? And then they would say there's four or five demands came in, but it didn't work out. The program didn't work. From both standpoints, oftentimes the contestant who was getting the job, the carpenter, wasn't a very good carpenter.
Oh, I see.
So we'd send him all to some state someplace, and he wouldn't produce.
Oh.
And then the jobs maybe he went to... weren't very good, maybe. So they took it off after about a year.
But it was, I think, a decent attempt to try to put a returning veteran in touch
yeah.
with a job someplace.
Well, I've often thought back on my career, and the main theme of what I tried to do on radio and television was to help somebody. Mm-hmm. Because then you can't go wrong. If you give $1,000 away, that's like Santa Claus, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Then later on, as that phased out, I got into my youth program, and that was helping people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk with you about the Youth Opportunity Program.
Good.
And some of the people that you discovered, not only on that show, but throughout your career, after we take a short break. We're talking with Horace Hite. We're talking with Horace Hite, who has had an outstanding career in the field of entertainment, radio and television, and the big band era. I think you were a major part of the big band era. We were talking about the Youth Opportunity Program, which came along in the middle to late 1940s, wasn't it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How did that become a radio show? Where did that start? What was the seed of
beginning? Well, it just started by me giving opportunity to people in San Francisco. I just knew it was a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
So then we put it into a form of putting on five contestants. And the secret of that success of that program was it traveled.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all the other talent shows that you see now, they all stay in one place.
Mm-hmm.
But there's just thousands of people out there in the country that live in small cities that can't get to New York or Chicago mm-hmm. or Los Angeles. And even if they did, where would they go, you know, to be mm-hmm. heard? Mm-hmm. So we went in, we had scouts, and we would audition these people. And then we put them on the air, and we have a winner, and from that came many, many people.
And you'd bring them out here and put them on, and then there was a vote.
No. We traveled to their city uh-huh. to first discover.
Right.
Like Art Carney, we went up to New Rochelle, New York, to a fair, and Art Carney was selling soda pop. But with that, he would do an impersonation. If somebody asked for a certain kind of a drink, a soft drink of some kind, mm-hmm. then he would do, say, Eddie Cantor.
Oh, uh-huh.
And then if they asked for another sort, then he'd do Roosevelt, who was president. So I was fascinated. The kids uh-huh. were screaming, you know, and yelling for him to perform. Would you like to come down to the Biltmore Hotel in New York and do your act? And he did, and he was a sensation. You know, he was called to the White House when Roosevelt heard so much about it that he called him to New York, and then he did Al Smith at the Biltmore Hotel, and that filled us up for a couple of years. But Art Carney was a wonderful person.
What else did these people do on your show? I want to talk immediately about probably the most famous of your discoveries from that program, and that was the accordionist Dick Contino.
He was any bigger than Al Hurt.
No, Al Hurt would be...
Or I wouldn't say he's any bigger than Gordon McRae.
No, sir. But I don't know that so many people realize that Gordon McRae got his start on...
My show?
On your show.
Well, he was a page boy at uh-huh. NBC. And he's just hoping to get a break. And mm-hmm. I was there, my show was there, and I had him come up on the stage and sing. He auditioned in the washroom while I was washing my hands. And I said, well, go
ahead.
All
the world's a stage.
So I said, go ahead and sing. And he sang, and it was beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I've seen Gordon in pictures now. He really was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize how great he was until I saw some of his pictures, the Carousel and South Pacific, I guess. But
Oklahoma, he was. Yeah.
He was a coming star of America, mm-hmm. there's no doubt. But he was a great star of America.
Well, he had his own radio series, too, for a long time, the Railroad Hour.
Yes, he did. Uh-huh. Then he got sick, I guess, and couldn't continue. Mm-hmm. Still, mm-hmm. you know, Gordon's still doing well. He's alive.
He's going around doing some work here and there. He's performing. He was in Chicago not too long ago.
Oh, was he really?
Yes, he was.
Well, he's a wonderful boy. Wonderful.
Now, did you send out units?
No, that was Major Bowes.
Major Bowes did that. But
that was Major mm-hmm. Bowes' big mistake. Uh-huh. When the public finds out that you're trying to make money off of the people you've discovered, mm-hmm. you're out of luck. You see, I never had a contract with anybody that I discovered. Uh-huh. They were free as the wind. And that made it an authentic program. But if you send them out in units and try to make money, then that's the downfall of it.
So when these performers would go out...
We would have a big celebration mm-hmm. and say, may the Lord be with you. We're proud that you started on our show.
Mm-hmm.
We did everything we could to help. And look at Frankie Carr. Look where he went to.
Oh,
he had his own band, was doing great. Yeah. Albina Ray had his own mm-hmm. band, doing great.
Lionel Hampton was involved with your...
No, he wasn't. No, Lionel Hampton came into my life when I had a ballroom in Los Angeles, and the Trianon Ballroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought that for me to play in, my own band, to keep mm-hmm. them busy during the summer. But business was no good, you know, for my own band.
Uh-huh.
So we had to move aside. And Lionel Hampton came in, and he just put us out of business, put me out of business.
But he paid the rent, so you were doing okay.
He paid the rent. He doubled or tripled any business uh-huh. we ever thought of doing.
You talked about Art Carney as a comedian who got his start on your Youth Opportunity Program. And before we started our tape rolling today, you mentioned Johnny Stanley.
Johnny in the Book Stanley.
Yeah, it's in the book, right?
Oh, yes. He was sensational.
What part of the country did he come from?
Oklahoma. Uh-huh. Oklahoma City. His father had a TED show. Now, Johnny did live just around the corner here. And on this tape that I just gave you, mm-hmm. you have probably one of the only recordings left of us in the book. Incidentally, if people would like to buy that tape or get it, they could write me here.
Oh, okay. How do we get it? We write to Horace Height?
Yeah, write to Horace Height, mm-hmm. Post Office Box 1900, Van Nuys, California, 91423.
91423, Van Nuys?
91404. They made a special box. 91404 is the zip, but it's Box 1900.
Box 1900?
And they send in a check for $10, and we'll send them a tape of all the people on that. Okay.
Well, let's see. You've given me the tape here, and we have Bill Finnegan, who was an arranger of yours.
Well, he arranged with me after Glenn passed. Glenn Miller.
Glenn Miller. Uh-huh.
He did arrangements on this tape, and then there was the others that you see listed there.
And you have Frankie Carl with T for Two. It's in the book with Johnny Stanley. Riding to Glory on a Trumpet by Horace Height.
Or no, just how like about Riding to Glory on a Trumpet? Uh-huh. Oh, yes, that's where I sang the chorus. But the big one is Hot Lips.
Hot Lips.
That's Al Hurt, Red Nichols, and Pete Condoli.
It's all right. We have the, in addition to that, you have Fred Lowry, the Whistling Cowboy.
The Blind Whistler from Texas.
Dick Contino plays Lady of Spain.
Right.
And Donna and the Don Juans with the Hutsut Serenade.
Oh, they were great. They were sensational.
This is Jim. Are you going to do anything with a record on this?
Yes, I'm going to make a record of that.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's marvelous to hear. Some of the great entertainment, all backed up by Horace Height and his musical nights.
Yeah, the original records,
yeah.
Yes.
They've been hard to find for a long time. Now you've got them. Now we've got them. Gang, we can go out and get them.
Yeah.
And we'll get those $10 checks coming your way.
Well, that'll be wonderful.
Then you'll get some $1 million worth of entertainment going the other way. That's super. Now, you have been out here for some 25 years with this
Yes,
community.
I bought this property. This is 10 acres of ground.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been around the golf course? And
a little bit, yes. We had a chance to stroll through here.
But you went through the houses and back. They're beautiful little houses. And there's 10 acres of apartments and houses and beautiful living. And we have parties for every month mm-hmm. for our friends, real good shows. We had a wonderful show last night. We had, it was so much, there was Patrick Sullivan Burke for St. Patrick's Day. You couldn't beat that. And he's a great person. Then we had Mr. Sharman on. He was great. He's something. He's a great actor. And his wife is a wonderful dancer.
You're,
as Mr. Sharman says, everything he owns is behind him. Dr. Sharman.
We shall not comment. Your band is still going. Your band is going strong these days. But
yes,
it's Horace
it
Height Jr. who's taking it on the road, right?
And he just completed a tour throughout America. And we were all very pleased that he did so well.
Now, he went with, I met him before we stopped by here, and he said that he was with the Modern Heirs, Paula Kelly and the Modern Heirs, and Helen Forrest
was with the
group.
Yes.
And Johnny Desmond.
Yes.
And he said he's out reaching thousands of people every time they do a performance, people who are clamoring not only for the musical memories that he's stirring with the Horace Height Orchestra, but also for this big band sound, the sound of natural music coming without the with all the electronics and without all the gimmickry, I think.
Music always changes.
Mm-hmm.
One fad after another. I understand isn't there some computer out now that sounds like an orchestra?
I hope not.
I think this computer that you put in certain chords and certain notes and it plays beautiful music for you.
Did you moved into television?
Yes.
In the early 1950s.
Yeah, with the television was with the Pot of Gold.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, with the Pot of Gold, and then the Treasure Chest, then Family Night with Horace Heidt, and then the American Wave.
Mm-hmm. The American Way was in the 1950s again. Then,
yeah, that was later on.
Yeah. Did Horace Heidt and his musical nights ever find their way onto any of the Hollywood sound stages to appear in any movies?
Oh yeah, we were in the Pot of Gold movie.
The film Pot of Gold.
Uh-huh. And I had a big chance then. I was given a very good part in this picture, but. I lost it. I mean, on the very first scene, Jimmy Stewart was to run down these stairs, and I was supposed to say, "Why, hello, Jimmy, how are you? Nice to see you." So he ran down the stairs, and I got tongue-tied and couldn't say it. So they came up to me, and George Marshall was the producer. He said, "What's the matter?" I said, "Well, it just won't come out." And I was pretty discouraged. So I told him at one time that I stammered very badly.
Mm-hmm.
But that was more or less, that's the truth, I did. I couldn't talk. But I really didn't want to play the part in the picture at that particular time. I didn't think I could do very well in it. So I just talked myself out of a chance to be in the picture.
You could have gone on to Lord knows what. You know. But of course, you did play.
You see, after Jim ran down nine times, he said, "I'm all in. I can't
do it anymore.
I can't do it anymore. So you can't talk, Heidi." He said, "We have to change the scene."
What was over a long career, and a career that spans more than 50 years mm-hmm. for you? What would you consider to be the highlight of that? Was there one incident or?
Well, there
a series
wasn't
of
one.
Incidents?
I'd say the highlight was. I was discovering all these people that are carrying on now and doing well. You see, that was a great credit. It is a great credit to the program that we had, that mm-hmm. it was on the up and up and a show, and we mm-hmm. really wanted to help people get ahead. It was a very sincere effort. So I'd say that was the biggest thing, to see all these people doing well now.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone is very grateful and very nice to me. There's not one that doesn't... you know, that's ever said, I don't know how to say it exactly, but they always write to me and thank me and things of that kind.
So you do hear then from many of
them? Oh, yes, I hear from.
How many people appeared on that, the Youth Opportunity Program, over the years?
Well, I don't know. It's how many we auditioned.
Mm-hmm.
Thousands, hundreds of thousands. Mm-hmm. See, in each city you had 400 or 500.
And you heard them all, huh?
Somebody well, my scouts
staff,
would hear them,
scouts, yeah.
And then I'd hear the last five,
mm-hmm.
and then we put the last three on the air.
Did you make the final decision as to
no,
who
No, the
went
audience,
on the air?
That's the trick.
No, I mean as to who went on your program.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
I'd listen to the people, and I'd just... You see, I had, thank goodness, an ability. If you take somebody that was just a raw amateur... and make him look like a star mm-hmm. in about a week's time. Now, you do that, it sounds impossible. But you, number one, you change their song, probably. You put a great arrangement behind them. If it's a girl, you buy her a beautiful dress, send her to a hairdresser and get her all fixed up.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time you put her on the air and rehearse her, and she has sung this song for a week in our stage show, in other cities, you see, as we travel,
yes, uh-huh.
we take these people with us from each city.
Oh, and they'd appear on the stage with your
for
show
a full
before
week,
they, got
before
on
they
the
went
air.
On the air. So they were all broken in.
They had a greater degree of confidence.
It's a great idea. And sure I can't understand why networks don't pick it up now. With all these things that they have on the air that they cancel. Here they have my son. You know, he's a handsome boy.
Yes.
And why they won't put him on with the original Youth Opportunity Program, I can't understand.
Yeah, but you know, the programmers, the executives today, they say, it won't work without giving it a try.
That's right.
That's the easiest words to roll off the tongue. It won't work. Nobody's going to watch. No one's going to listen.
Yes.
I mean, anybody in the business has heard that a lot, and it's too bad because the public likes to see young people or old people just going for it, giving it a shot at it, getting a chance to do it.
Right.
Some win, some lose, but they're all, you say, but he's got courage to get up there and do that.
Right.
And it's nice that this person gives him the opportunity.
That's the American people. They want to give the underdog the break, always.
But unless the programmers feel that you can upset a program that's been on for five seasons and has high ratings, it isn't going to work. And then they put something else on that they think will work, and it doesn't work anyway. So what?
Yes, but the funny part was that the original youth always got high ratings.
Mm-hmm.
We were never out of the first 10 on radio and on television. But they just won't listen to it now. The whole trend is to come to Hollywood and have a sitcom, you know, just have a lot of people up there talking.
Well, you keep plugging with it, you and your son, and maybe both of you will come back to Chicago. I know you stick around in this lovely surroundings a lot these days, but it would be nice if you and your son and the band would get back to the Drake Hotel for a couple of weeks or
someplace. Well, you know, he was back there. Horace was back there for 2 years.
Back in the
at Drake Hotel in Chicago.
Was it the early 70s or the late 60s?
No, just 2 or 3 years ago. He went back to the Camille Room before they closed it. And we put on the talent search hunt from the Drake Hotel, and it was tremendous. But the management of the Drake, a wonderful man by the name of Ben Schuler, he didn't want to get the crowd from the Knickerbocker across the street from the Drake.
Mm-hmm.
And he was afraid if we put on this talent program that we'd get those people over into the Camille Room of the Drake Hotel. I didn't agree with that thinking, but he was the boss.
Well, there's always some boss who doesn't agree.
That's right. But it's all right, Bev. He did the best he wanted. He kept the Drake Hotel, kept it a beautiful hotel.
Well, if you can't get back to Chicago, I bring greetings from all of your fans out there to you. And I want to thank you very much for sharing some memories with us today.
Okay.
Thank you, Horace Height.
Okay, thank you.